All right, welcome everyone to our second seminar of the year. And today we have our own Anurag, who will tell us about sample efficient learning of quantum many body systems. And Anurag said it's okay to just interrupt him with questions. I will also try to monitor the chat. So take it away.
Yeah, thanks Felix. Thanks a lot for inviting. So this is my last week in Waterloo almost. So, you know, it's nice to talk to you about this work here. And then run away, even if you don't like it. So, you know, it's not my problem. So let me do what I'm supposed to do. Sorry, here. Okay. All right. So this is a joint work with Srinivasan at IBM, Tomotaka at in Japan, and Mehdi in from MIT. All right. So I will talk about sample efficient learning of quantum many-body systems. You know, in the following sections, I will describe the setup, describe you know, like some background work. There are lots and lots of very interesting classical literature on this topic. I will talk about all of that. There might be a lot of slides, so you know, I might not end it. That's totally fine. But one thing that might help the audience a lot, depending on what interest you have from this talk, is that you'll see that most of the titles of the slides, they are either blue or orange or red. So the way to interpret that is that if it's blue, then it's something very accessible. It's almost story-like and you can just follow through. If it's orange, then it's going to get a little technical. And once you see a red one, you can just go to sleep. I mean, if you're really not interested in the technicalities. So, you know, that way, at least you will not miss anything important. So let's see, how does that go? I have tried it once before and no one really cared, but hopefully that doesn't happen this time. All right, so there are three sections here. First one is learning graphical models. This will be a classical, entirely classical section. I'll describe all the classical work, followed by learning quantum Hamiltonians, the motivations and so on. And then I'll talk about some of the techniques, which will have most of the red slides. All right, so let's talk about classical graphical models. As far as I'm aware, they have several names. They're also called Markov random fields, Boltzmann machines, and so on. Depending on what you are working on, they may have, you know, also different interpretation. But formally, one defines these objects by fixing a graph. Let's say the one in this picture over here, which has six nodes. And the structure of the graph gives us information about the conditional independence. So what it means from this picture is that, for example, these six variables or these vertices correspond to variables, random variables, and they have a joint distribution. Now, condition on the first variable being certain fixed value, conditional independence means that if you fix some value over here, then x3 is going to be independent of everything over here, which means x3 is entirely determined by x1. In general, any random variable, it will be independent of all the other variables if I fix its neighbors. So that's what the conditional independence refers to. Now, there's a very well-known result in classical literature, which is known as the Hammersley-Clifford theorem, which says that assuming that the distribution on these variables is positive, it's a technical condition, assuming that the distribution is given by the Gibbs function, in some sense, or Gibbs distribution, or Gibbs state, depending on, I don't know how do you call it, of certain Hamiltonian. So it's e to the power minus beta, which is inverse temperature, times some operator which has a local structure. And let me quickly describe what it looks like. The quantity z beta is the normalization factor. It's the partition function, which also might be well known among the audience here. And the object here is the Hamiltonian, and it respects the graphical structure, which means that the edge here, these hij, they only act non-trivially on the edges of the graph. It's like you see in the picture. So as you can see, if the distribution was of this form, then it has this graph, it has this conditional structure, which I will not prove it, but it's a matter of checking. At the same time, what this result shows that any distribution on this, which has certain conditional independence, has this Gibbs property. And a well-known example of this is the Ising model, which is the, if you require your Hamiltonian to be two local, then it acts on two particles, and these Xi's are bits, then this is the most general form of the Hamiltonian that you can write. And which is clear, it has a quadratic term and a linear term. And these Hij, they respect the structure, and this is also known as Ising model. All right. So,
Can you just clarify what you mean by if the distribution is positive?
Oh, so some places it could be zero, right? So we don't want this to be zero. So I think the beta is determined by the smallest probability, and that could sometimes, if some string could have zero probability, then this will not be true anymore. And you can see, right? I mean, Gibbs distribution is always positive. It's never really zero for finite beta.
So this condition is another way of saying it's full support?
Yeah, it's full support. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, so what's important here is Gibbs, that the Gibbs distribution comes up in this work, in this line of thought. And we'll kind of center ourselves to Gibbs distribution. So even if someone hasn't seen this theorem and so on, it doesn't really matter. We'll mostly focus on Gibbs distribution for now. All right. So let me quickly motivate what is the importance of graphical models. In many situations where there's a lot of data and one expects there to be some nice connection between the data, but one doesn't really know what the connection is. For example, one very well known example would be the protein-protein interaction graph. These vertices are the proteins, and the connections describe something. Maybe something expresses something, and so on. I don't know. So, given a huge amount of data, one can represent, the correlations, the connections between these using graphical models. In fact, in much of machine learning, one assumes that even though there are lots of data, there is an underlying nice structure that one wants to figure out. So that's where also these graphical models become important. And the central problem over here is that can several parameters be learned with a few samples? So for example, if I want to figure out the interaction between these proteins or something, and I don't have too many samples from the experiment, then can I learn it? And that's probably one of the important challenges of machine learning. In fact, even if you're purely physics minded, this is a very interesting problem. So imagine you're considering a Gibbs distribution of an Ising model, but you don't know what the interactions are and you would like to figure it out. So this is known as the inverse Ising problem. So unlike the case where I know the interaction, then I figure out the physics, I want to use the physics to figure out the interaction between the variables or the spins. So this is known as the inverse Ising problem, and again, it is a very similar kind of task. I will formally define it in one of the few slides very soon. If someone is very interested, this is a nice reference for to study about these. And if you ask me, I'll send you the link. All right. So here's a technical slide which is going to describe the problem of learning graphical models. So imagine that you are given samples from a distribution P of beta. Beta is the temperature, and P is the Gibbs distribution that I showed you earlier, where you promise that the distribution is of some Ising model. And then there are some more promises which make sense. For example, these coefficients mu and theta, they're not too ill-behaved. They are, of moderate size, which makes sense. You don't want certain pair of spins to interact too strongly. That's slightly unphysical assumption. So there's a spelling mistake here, but regardless, we assume that these interactions are bounded. They're not too strong. And
sorry, fine. Anurag, but you could always rescale it, no?
True, but you don't want mu 1, 2 and mu 10, 11 to be widely different, for example. Mm-hmm. Also one. Yeah, so if you rescale it, one more thing would happen is that the temperature beta would change because you have absorbed the rescaling factor in beta. And that could affect the performance of some of the algorithms. So does it make sense, Alex?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And one more assumption that is made, which is important, is that the underlying graph that I showed you has small degree, although graph may not be known. And this is important because one expects that a certain variable doesn't interact with too many other variables. So there is some underlying nice structure to the graph, which one can actually, which one hopes is actually what describes the physics. And one hopes that one can learn it. So the problem is that how many samples from this distribution, independent samples from this distribution, I need to figure out mu prime and theta prime to output these real numbers mu prime and theta prime, such that there are two possibilities, which I will often come back to in this talk, but they both ask that these variables to be close to these variables. So for those who are interested in the technical content, you might want to take a note of these. So first one is the L infinity guarantee, which is basically saying that each of the mu prime should be close to mu and each of the theta prime should be close to theta by some error epsilon, which for the purpose, let's fix it to be some constant like 1 over 10 or 1 over 20. Another guarantee that I'll keep coming to is the L2 guarantee, which says that if you look at mu and mu prime as vectors, then the vectors are close, which roughly says that as the square root of the square distance between the vectors is less than epsilon, and similarly for the theta. So these are just two conditions you ask the algorithm to satisfy, and then the algorithm behaves, does something depending on what the task is.
Quick question. Do you know the underlying graph structure and you don't know the coefficients, or you don't know anything?
So in the literature of graphical models, they do not know the underlying graph structure, but they know that it has a small degree.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is a natural assumption. Otherwise, if there was a complete dependence without any control, I'm not sure what happens in that case. Maybe.
One quick question. I mean, the mu ijs, if they're zero, then there's no edge, right? So they also tell you the graph structure if you get
right
from the algorithm.
Right. You're right. Yeah. So one way to phrase it is that many, many mu ijs are zero. Right. So which ensures that the graph has a lot of edges. So in fact, I didn't highlight it here, but one often assumes in the algorithms that study this task, that these mu ijs are not only between 1 minus 1, they're also not too small. Like it's like they're like 0.1, at least 0.1, something like that. And then one fixes the graph structure. Anyway, so these are the guarantees, and there's a huge amount of classical literature studying these models because of its relevance to, I believe, because of the relevance to machine learning and all. So it starts from 1963, and lots and lots of authors have studied this task. And their aim is to find good algorithms which are time efficient, and the number of samples required from this distribution is not too large. So very recently, starting from somewhere around 2015, there has been a series of results which are able to give, very good algorithms and provable guarantees on this task. So these are rigorous results in this direction. In practice, I'm sure people do much better, but what's amazing is that theoretically, a lot has been done and very, very good results have been obtained. So let me go through that quickly. So these authors, finally, that culminated in this work, have shown that the sample complexity of this task is roughly log of the number of vertices in the graph that I showed you, times some factor that depends on the temperature. Let's ignore this for now. And time complexity is just square of the number of vertices. So it's very efficient. If you have quite a large number of vertices, the samples needed is just log of that large number, which usually tends to be small. And time complexity is not too bad. And in fact, I believe these authors also implemented their algorithm numerically, and they ran it on the D-Wave machine or something, and it works well in the practice. So let me quickly recap what we have seen so far. So learning graphical models is an important task. Several classical algorithms have achieved this. I didn't mention this a few seconds back, but they learned this graph in the L infinity norm. And that is enough to figure out the underlying graph structure. So for example, if your mu's and thetas were either ones or zero, and your epsilon was half, then learning these values in learning each coefficient up to an error of half is enough to ensure that your graph is known to you. So L infinity helps in learning the graph, and that's what their main task was. Just to appreciate what has been achieved by the classical works is that if you think about it, the number of unknown graphs of a fixed degree, let's say degree 3 or 4, on G vertices is exponential in the size of G, the number of vertices, times some log factor. These algorithms achieve sample complexity of log of G, which is doubly exponential better than the number of graphs that are around. So it's a massive reduction in the cost when you think about sample complexity. Time complexity is, of course, polynomial in G, but you know, which is also an exponential improvement over what you could just think by purely information theoretic method. So this reduction seems to be a very powerful result in this direction. Okay, any questions?
Yes, I'm wrong. What is the scaling in epsilon?
So I do not remember, unfortunately. Sorry, I think it's this over epsilon or this over epsilon square. I'm not sure. It's not too bad.
So 1 on epsilon, not e to the 1 on epsilon or something.
Yeah. I think it's a good scaling.
So is the third bullet a lower bound or stop?
The third bullet can be used to provide lower bounds, showing that this is tight. But I was just trying to highlight the reduction in the cost, I guess. By some kind of counting argument, people have shown lower bounds on that you need log of G sample complexity. Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Okay, so now I'll talk about the quantum version of this problem. All right, so here's our favorite many-body systems. It has a collection of particles, let's say electrons, and they're interacting in a local fashion. I believe many of you might have seen this. And we'll be defining it formally with a very similar structure. All right, so here's the formal definition. Keeping in mind the Ising model, let's say we have a Hamiltonian, which is local. So what does it mean? It's a collection of M terms where these coefficients EL are some operators that only act on a few number of particles. So for example, in this picture, EL could be two body operators, just as an example. We assume, as before, mu's are not too large, they're between -1 and 1. And these E's are also not too large, which just means that I don't want a certain pair of spins to interact too strongly, which is a reasonable assumption to make. One example is that you could think of E's to be poly operators. So for example, in the picture that I showed here, it could be two qubit poly operators. So you could expand your Hamiltonian in terms of that. So we fix this operators, let's call it basis, and we want to figure out the coefficients. And the Gibbs state is defined for a certain temperature beta, is exponential in the Hamiltonian divided with the partition function, which is defined just like in the classical world, it's trace of this Gibbs operator. So this is normalized. All right, so you might be guessing what the task is now. Task is to figure out these coefficients, but before that, let's see why would someone be interested in that.
And similarly, you don't have one spin which interacts with every other spin, right?
Right. So one assumption that I should have highlighted here is that it is the underlying graph will assume that it doesn't interact too strongly with other. It is low degree. Yeah. In fact, for the results that I will mention, we also need to assume that graph is a lattice. Which earlier works, the classical works.
In what sense?
You can define it formally in terms of expansion, like how much volume.
Lattice, because there are, lattice as a, like it's put on a plane or something like that, right?
Oh yeah, so it could be any finite dimension lattice. Which lattice is it can be unknown because you can encode that in the mu's. I think the Felix pointed out, right, that mu's, some mu's are zero, then those edges are not there. But yeah, but it is certain, some kind of lattice, yeah. Mm-hmm. Finite dimension, like 3-4 dimension is fine. All right. So Well, first reason is that there are a lot of recent learning results in various domains of quantum learning theory, or we call it quantum machine learning. So several works have studied sample complexity of very basic learning tasks, which had already been studied classically, have been studied classically very extensively. Some examples are supervised learning, shadow tomography, quantum Boltzmann machines. This is close, very close to what this model is. And in fact, it turns out that this inverse problem of figuring out the interactions just by doing experiments with the unknown Hamiltonian, it can be very important for in real world systems. So for example, lattice structure plays a very important role in the physics of the system. So it might be important to figure out what the lattice structure is, or the type of interaction is important for classifying the phases of matter. The spectral gap is important, and so on. So there have been some experimental push as well, where people try to do experiments and figure out the interaction that comes in the system. Another motivation that comes from the upcoming quantum computing revolution is that Gibbs sampling, which means building a machine that can sample from the Gibbs distribution of certain Hamiltonian, has become very important for several quantum algorithms. So if someone designs a machine like that, first thing one would like to do is to verify that this Gibbs sampler is doing what it's supposed to do. That means you get a sample from a Hamiltonian, which you hope that is the right Hamiltonian, but you want to test it and verify that indeed that's the right Hamiltonian. So that's where you need to learn the Hamiltonian. So that's another application one can think of. So yeah, so with this motivation, let me describe what has been known. There have been a series of works in recent years trying to solve this problem. So a series of works which came very recently, what they did is that they set up certain linear system of equations, which I will not describe at all in this talk, but I highly recommend. It's a very elegant idea. And then they said that if you can solve this system of equations, then you can figure out the parameters mu. Their method applies to Gibbs state and ground states as well, or in fact, high energy eigenstates. But the issue is that these works do not tell you rigorous conditions under which this inversion is possible, this solving linear systems equation is possible. Sometimes there might be too many solutions and you don't know which one to choose. So assuming that you can invert this system of equations, then you can solve the problem. And these methods are also very practical.
And these ones use HHL?
This linear system of equations are classical linear system of equations. So you do experiment with your sample and you write down a classical problem to solve. So yeah, but yeah, you could, it's hard to say whether you could speed that up using HSL because you don't have superposition over those problems anyway. So I won't go into those details.
I see.
Thanks for the question. And at the same time, there have been some there was an experimental demonstration under the ability to perform time evolution under the unknown Hamiltonian. And there are several other results in this direction. So let me jump into what we show. So let's consider a Hamiltonian which is on a geometrically local graph, which I believe this answers Alex's question. Recall, just reminding you the notation, that H looks like summation over these local terms, where the unknowns are these coefficients mu, E's are local, they could be Pauli operators. So we give an algorithm which fails with a tiny probability delta. This can be small. And whenever it doesn't fail, also you will know when you failed. I think, this I should have thought about. But anyway, if someone has this question, then I don't remember right now, sorry. So if you don't fail, then you output a mu prime, which is close to mu in L2 norm epsilon, which is a stronger notion of closeness. And the number of samples needed, just then parse through this very complicated expression. It's exponential in the temperature up to some polynomial factor, let's ignore that, C and C prime are constants. It's 1/ε² in the error parameter. There's a weak dependence on the delta, which is the probability that you fail. And the dominating sample complexity is m cubed. M is the number of terms in the Hamiltonian. So let's see, to get a bit more intuition, if your beta is too small, that means you are at a very high temperature regime, then every Gibbs distribution is a uniform distribution. There is no information about the Hamiltonian present anywhere in the system. So sample complexity goes to infinity because you cannot figure out anything at all. If beta is very small, then you are going to the ground state regime. Sorry, if beta is very large, then you're going to the ground state regime. And in that case, our techniques don't work very well. So again, our sample complexity explodes. In the intermediate regime, we get our sample complexity like this for any beta. And we also prove a lower bound that any algorithm which would like an L2 guarantee epsilon requires at least root m over beta number of samples. So if you look at the dominating factor of m, then this is polynomially tight, and there's a lot of room for improvement in both directions. And in fact, our example here is a classical Hamiltonian. So this lower bound is also true classically. Anyway, so any questions about this slide?
I have one, sorry. In the assumption, the two uses of local, is that the same, or are these like, if?
Right. These are not the same local. So geometrically local means that your graph looks like a lattice. Let's say it's in 2-dimension or 3-dimension or 4-dimension space. This local means that it's acting on small number of qubits or qubits. So if I remove this sentence, this phrase from here, geometrically local graph, if I remove, then this could also be a complicated graph. Like degree, like, you know.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So it's sort of, so I'm referring to physical Hamiltonians, which live in our real world. And C depends on the degree of the graph or the lattice. So if degree and other properties, so it doesn't work when graph is some complicated graph living in a very high dimension space. All right. Some more properties of our algorithm is that the algorithms consist of a simple quantum measurement on a small number of qubits followed by classical post-processing. That means I'll mention time complexity later, but the time complexity will all be a part of the classical post-processing. And I will discuss this later in one of the later slides. So it's time efficient in some cases, not all cases. All right, just to set in place with previous results, classical results, they are very, very excellent. They are time efficient and sample near optimal. We are time efficient only conditionally, and we are polynomially optimal in sample complexity. So there's room for improvement and definite room for improvement here. Classical works, they mostly care about recovering the graph, underlying graph. We require the graph to be geometrically local. So we are far behind the classical world. But the good news is that they took quite a while to reach here. So we have time, let's say 50 years, I'd say, maybe. Our graph has to be geometrically local, but we can still figure out the lattice structure. So if you have a collection of potential lattices, then you can formulate the problem in a manner that you can figure out the lattice. They work in L infinity norm because it's enough to determine the graph. L2 norm is too costly for them as well, because as I mentioned in the previous slide, a root m lower bound holds classically. We work in L2 guarantee, and we do not know a good answer in L infinity guarantee, which I'll come to this in one of the later slides. And for us, one motivation for L2 guarantee is that it's a very strong notion of closeness. So you really know your Hamiltonian very well, and you can figure out, for example, spectral gap and so on, a lot of global properties. Comparison to quantum results. So the previous quantum results, their results were sample complexity was conditional. And for example, it depended on the properties of the linear system that they set up. Our sample complexity is provably efficient at all temperature regime. Other results could also work with ground states. We can only work with Gibbs states because, as I mentioned earlier, when the beta becomes very large, then our algorithm doesn't work. It requires too many samples. Okay, so just to recap, the talk so far, learning quantum Hamiltonians is a natural generation of the classical graphical model. Our algorithm, it learns in L2 guarantee. Its sample complexity is n cube, and know that algorithm can do better than root n. This improvement. We are time efficient in some regimes. The earlier works were always time efficient, but their sample complexity was not guaranteed. So, but you could also argue that if sample complexity is bad, then time complexity is also bad. So sometimes these algorithms would not work. All right, so that's the talk. Okay, so any questions so far regarding the whole talk?
So you have like two temperatures, right? Beta C and beta C prime. One of them is the temperature at which you sample from. Is that how it is?
This is beta to the power C and beta to the power C.
Oh, so I
this
see.
Is the same. And this is the exponent. There's some polynomial in beta and another polynomial in beta.
I see. And then you assume that you can sample from the Hamiltonian in the same temperature you're going to learn it.
Right. So one gets a sample at a certain temperature, yeah, and one figures out that. That's right. So we know the temperature in some sense. Yeah. But it can be any temperature. It doesn't have to be high temperature. It can be low temperature as well. All right. So that's the talk so far. Now I'll jump into the techniques involved. So Felix, how much time do I have?
A good 25 minutes, more actually.
Cool.
I mean, there's questions throughout, so yeah.
Right.
Let's go to the end.
Thanks. Okay. So the basic technique that we are going to use is the concept of sufficient statistics, which I will describe in the next two slides. So the idea here is that if you're given a Gibbs state of some Hamiltonian, let's say the Hamiltonian is a two local Hamiltonian. Let's say all these E's act on two qubits only, then this says that the marginals of the Gibbs state, that means the two body marginals, uniquely determine the Hamiltonian. So let me describe what it means. So let's say my Hamiltonian is this, as before. And suppose I knew exactly the following numbers. That means I knew trace of this operator E with the Gibbs state for every L. I knew all these expectation values. As you recall, E's could be Pauli operators. Then it says that if there is any other collection of vectors, mu prime, for which these expectations match, that means expectation of the Gibbs state for mu and expectation of the Gibbs state for mu prime, if they match, then it must hold that mu and mu prime are the same. That means the Hamiltonians are the same. This is just another way of saying that information theoretically, the knowledge of EL completely determines the parameters mu. And notice here that because EL only acts on a few number of qubits, what matters here is just the reduced state of the Gibbs state on those qubits. So which means that the local information of the Gibbs state determines the Hamiltonian. I will soon give a picture proof of this in one of the slides later, but let's look at why is it important.
Hey, quick question. Do you need to know E sub L exactly? Because, you know, I would imagine that you measure some Pauli operator, you can get plus minus one, you do it 10 times and you have some uncertainty, no?
Right, so that's the problem that we address in this talk. That's what we'll be solving. So Alex, I'll get to your question. This is a very, very good question. I'll get to it in this slide. So anyway, just some history. This idea goes back to Jaynes in a different language. It is used very extensively in the classical literature, and even in the quantum world, this idea has been used in different forms. I recommend these results. So, as you can guess, here is a very natural learning method, which was first observed by these authors, which is that compute these expectation values exactly. Let's say you could do that. Then, information theoretically, at least, you can figure out this parameter is mu. Now, issue, as Alex mentioned, is that we can only approximate EL. Given samples from the Gibbs distribution, we will never be able to figure out exactly what these EL are. We'll know some E prime, which is close to E. So how do we solve this problem if we all know the approximate answer? So this problem was left unresolved, and in this talk, we'll be solving it. All right. So here's where I will give you a visualization of the sufficient statistics, and it goes like this. So let's look at the partition function that I described earlier, z beta, which is the trace of the Gibbs operator. This function is numerator. It turns out that the log partition function is a convex function of mu, which what means pictorially is that if you plot log of the partition function against the parameter mu, which by the way is a m dimensional entry, it has m entries, but I'm just for convenience showing you just one direction, then this is a convex function, it looks like this. Now, if you recall from statistical mechanics, and even if you didn't take statistical mechanics, no problem. It turns out that these parameters EL that I mentioned, this is the trace of, which is the expectation value of E, this operator E with the Gibbs state. It turns out if I take the derivative of the log partition function with respect to the Lth coefficient, then I exactly get EL, which basically says that the partition function contains all the information about the Gibbs state. So first derivative contains the energies. And that's what it is here. So what it means is that if I exactly knew this EL, which means I knew the direction. So EL are the derivative of the partition function. Now, if I knew the direction, which is defined by these parameters EL, then I can figure out exactly the point where this direction is taken by, in, at least information theoretically, at least, without worrying about whether it's efficient or not. But the point is that if someone tells you the derivative of a convex function in all directions, then you can exactly figure out the point where that value of derivative, that tangent actually exists. So that's the point mu star we are interested in. I hope this point is clear. Okay, so the issue is that it's not that we know EL exactly, the direction exactly. We know some estimate E prime L, which is a different sort of direction. So if we did the same tasks that I mentioned earlier, we know this red direction and we're trying to find the unique point where the red direction is the tangent, then I'll be off from the original point. And what bad really can happen is that, for example, this partition function, it curves really slowly. That means it's almost like a straight line. Then this change in this angle would take me very far off from the original point mu star. And it turns out that the more curved is this curve, closer is our estimate mu prime to the original mu star. And that's what we need to show. So this curvature of the partition function of this drawing of the log partition function is this, I believe this is the first red slide of this talk, which is known as a strong convexity. So our main result, main technical result is that the log partition function is strongly convex, which means that the second derivative at every point, which roughly tells how does the tangent change, you know, that's what we're interested in. Faster the tangent changes, better is it for us, because then good knowledge of the tangent will make sure we don't go too far away. So it's that we show that the log partition function has this property that its second derivative across every point, at every point in every direction is large. And that mathematically is stated as follows, that the Hessian of the Hessian matrix of the log partition function, its smallest eigenvalue is not zero and it's quite large. So let's look at this again. This is the smallest eigenvalue and it is 1 over the number of particles, that's m. It is has some dependence on the temperature, beta to the power c prime, some constant, and e to the power minus beta to the power c. And this is a similar expression arises in our sample combination that I showed earlier. And this is for the same reason that this smallest eigenvalue shows up in the sample complexity. So if you recall, this is very similar to what I showed earlier in one of the slides. Anyway, classically, this 1 over m factor is not there. In fact, classically, a very strong result is known, which is that the derivative, the Hessian, is actually something that is independent of the number of particles and number of interaction terms. But for us, it makes a result like this would give us a polynomial improvement from m cubed to m. So our result is m cubed, this would improve it to m. Okay, but this is just a side note, but this is the main technical point that I'd like to explain in the next few slides. So before I describe this, let's see what happens classically and what do people really, how do people really prove this result that the log partition function is classically curved everywhere. So one thing is that the strong convexity is a very important tool in itself in anything that uses convex optimization, especially in many of these results that I mentioned earlier. They need to establish strong convexity of some function. So it's in itself, it's a very important primitive in many of the rigorous results. For the Gibbs state of Ising model or the graphical model that is described, the classical model, this problem of proving strong convexity reduces to proving that variance of local operators with respect to the Gibbs distribution is large. And that I'll explain in the next slide. So what this means is the following, that let's take an example. So let's say I have the Ising model, a very simple one, where the Hamiltonian is some over nearest neighbor Z interactions. And let's look at magnetization, that is the sum over all the Z operators. Now, if you compute the variance of magnetization with respect to the Gibbs state of this Ising model, it's not very hard to convince yourself that this number will be something that is proportional to the number of terms or number of particles. And this is a very generic phenomena. So what it's saying is that with high probability, the magnetization, it concentrates around the average magnetization plus minus root m, which you can prove by Chebyshev's inequality or something like that. Because the variance is proportional to m, not m squared, because notice that this function is a quadratic function of the magnetization, but still this object is proportional to m, it's linear in m, which means that something concentrates and that's magnetization. And it makes sense. We don't expect that something like magnetization will concentrate any better than this, that it will be like average plus minus 10, some constant. And this is a typical behavior in the study of independent or weakly independent distributions. As you know, if you have independent distributions, many observables, they behave in a Gaussian manner and they concentrate around the average, which is, you might think of it as central limit theorem, Chernoff bound, there are several names, but this is a very standard phenomenon. And one should think of Gibbs distribution as a type of weakly dependent distribution. And these classical results, when they prove this theorem, they're basically proving this fact in a rigorous and most general manner. So let's see what they prove. So here's a slide about what is known quantumly. So there are a series of works, I just put out here, which show that when beta is smaller, when the temperature is large, then for any local operator, not just magnetization, any local operator, any operator that is a sum of local terms, the variance is upper bounded by something that's linear in M, which follows from series of fold results. Classically, not only is this known, but it's also known that this is a lower bound. That means variance of this local operator is roughly omega of m for Gibbs state, where this lower bound depends on the temperature. Which says, as exactly what I said earlier, that the Gibbs distribution at low, small values of beta is sort of a weakly dependent distribution, and it's and these physical quantities concentrate. And the way they prove this result is via this Margov property that I mentioned in the first slide, which says that condition on some variable, a certain number of variables are independent of other variables, which is described by this graphical structure, that one variable is independent of the rest, condition on the neighbors. So this lower bound that's known classically is a consequence of this property. One uses this property to prove it. And which kind of makes sense, because if my Hamiltonian was independent, which is not interacting, then this result is very easy to prove. So this micro property allows you to kind of tap into that property. Quantumly, there is no such lower bound known. And one bottleneck is that this property simply is not true in the quantum case. Some weaker versions are true, but they don't help at all. So that's what we want, and there's no known result showing this type. So let me quickly, in this red slide, let me describe what is known classically. Classically, it's known as a given a Hamiltonian, and any local operator parameterized by parameters nu instead of mu, the variance of this local operator is at least this coefficient over here, which I will explain in a moment, times this function. And if you think of all nu's to be equal to 1, which happens, for example, for magnetization, then this is equal to m, and the variance is at least m times some constant. That's exactly what I described earlier, that the variance constant is. And this directly leads to the strong convexity. You can imagine that this expression, it's not very easy to see, but one can prove using this that classically partitioned function is strongly convex, and it's exactly this quantity over here that matters. And this is much harder in the quantum case. And what we prove is that this expression is at least this number divided by this factor m. So we have a weaker result of on the bound on the variance of local operator, which still says that the local operators have non-zero variance or fairly large variance in the quantum case as well. So with this loss. All right. So another slide, very quickly, I'm going to describe the techniques that we use. How do we prove it? So our first step is to use quantum belief propagation to reduce the strong convexity to proving variance lower bound, which was fairly easy classically, but quantum belief turns out to be non-trivial. Next, what we do is that we don't know, because of the lack of Markov property, we don't know how to handle these local operators. So we use a trick which reduces any operator, which is not a local operator, but a sum of local operators, to a local operator OI. And for those who know Fourier analysis, this might be familiar. You might think of it as the inference of a variable. Next, we show that this object has large variance. And then we use some known results, as well as the fact that Gibbs state has some nice properties, to say that this operator has large variance. So this is the three-step process, and that's it. And I want, and then 50 pages later, we're done. Sorry, it takes a while. it's not, we hope we can make it much simpler and shorter. That would be much useful, I guess. Anyway, so on time complexity, if you notice, we're trying to find this point mu star, which agrees with this direction over here. And that amounts to the following problem, which you can imagine is not too hard to convince yourself, that we have this log partition function, that's this curve, and we have this line, which is given by this parameters EL. We want to, if we minimize this function, then we exactly get this point mu star, which can be seen by taking just the derivative of this thing. So this function has a unique minimum, and then one can use gradient descent algorithms, for example, to solve this problem, and it's time efficient if the partition function is easy to compute. So that's it. So that is our task. Just minimize mu given these parameters, minimize this objective function. And whenever you can compute the partition function efficiently, that's where you get time efficiency. So for example, when you have high temperature, that's when you can get time efficiency. And also in the stochastic case, in these cases, you can get time efficiency. Now we know how to also deal with the commuting case. All right, so just to recap, this is the last slide, then I'll go to conclusion. Talk so far, sufficient statistics gives a natural approach to the learning problem. We prove a robust version of that by a strong convexity approach, which reduces to proving the lower bound the variance of a many-body local operator. And we expect that this result in itself will have many applications, because variance classically in itself is very important for proving lower bounds in other versions of learning algorithms. So we expect this to be of use elsewhere. So sorry, any questions so far in this section?
So I thought that you will use strong convexity to then do a second order method, but it seems like your learning algorithm is first order, right?
The learning algorithm is...
just gradient descent.
It's gradient descent.
But I think you get better complexity if you did second order method.
I see. Okay. Thanks. That is worth thinking about. Given that the function is strongly convex everywhere. All right, cool, thanks. I'll think about that. So how much improvement is there in the complexity usually?
I think you should expect the quadratic speedup, but then the Lipschitz constant of your function, the partition function shows up, which I think like norm of the Hamiltonian will show up, but then you get better scaling in epsilon.
I see. Okay, cool, thanks. All right, any more questions? Okay, so let me say a few words about what we expect of the future directions. So one intuitive, physically motivated possibility is to modify sufficient statistics in the following manner. Which is that, you know, let's say I have a lattice, 2D lattice, and as I mentioned earlier, that if I know the marginals of the distribution of the Gibbs state, then I know all the Hamiltonian. In particular, I know this Hamiltonian term. So this Hamiltonian term only depends on all the marginals of the Gibbs distribution, simply because every Hamiltonian term depends on that. But you would expect intuitively that this term should only depend on the marginals close to it on the lattice, like in a certain close neighborhood. So we expect that computing E, these expectations E, only in the neighborhood of a term should be enough to figure out what the term is. And then if this can be achieved, then this shows that estimation of this mu is a local procedure. And this local statistics sort of perspective, it could be used to obtain time-efficient algorithm, because then you just have to think about local terms everywhere, and then it's much more efficient. And this can be established, for example, in the commuting case on any lattice, which gives us a time-efficient algorithm for commuting Hamiltonians. So that clears up this case. I believe there are also other results using other methods that solve the commuting case, but the key challenge is, can we get something like this for the non-commuting general case, some version of that? And if you can achieve that, would lead to efficient learning algorithm, which I expect also would be near optimal in sample context. Finally, so this next question is that our strong convexity result was depending on M, it was 1 over M. And we expect physically that it should not be 1 over M at all, it should just be a constant. If you can achieve that, then that will improve our time convexity from M cubed to M. And just from the condensed matter point of view, this is a very interesting question on its own, because if a local observable, like something like magnetization, if its variance is very, very small, then it would somehow be in an eigenspace of the Hamiltonian, which physically doesn't make sense. So because our procedure, it reduces the whole problem to a local problem. That's why we have a loss, and we hope that it can be avoided. So with that, there are more questions, of course, which I can talk about, but thanks for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Anurag. Do we have any more questions? I have one. I was a little confused. Can you once more explain the connection between the locality assumptions, the sufficient statistics, and then this sufficient local statistics?
Right. So sufficient statistics says that, let me backtrack over here. So just one sec. So sufficient statistics says that if I know this EL for every L, that means if I know the, roughly it says that if I know the marginal of the Gibbs state everywhere, then that uniquely determines the Hamiltonian. It determines the parameters mu. But to figure out
this also in general.
This is true in general for any graph. Yes. But we expect that if I have a physical lattice, like on a three-dimensional, four-dimensional, two-dimensional, then mu 3, which is acting on qubits 1 and 2, I'm sorry, 2 and 3, for example, we should not have to determine the EL for 1 billion and 1 billion plus first qubit, figure out mu 2, 3, because that's too far away. So there should be a notion of locality coming from the lattice structure, which is what I meant by sufficient local statistics. And that requires local, you know, locality of the lattice.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Cool. Any more questions?
This might be a little bit off topic, but if you wanted to check if your quantum computer is actually sampling from the Gibbs distribution, would learning the Hamiltonian be the best way to do that, or an effective way to do that compared to other techniques?
I guess that's a very good question. Probably the right problem is testing the Hamiltonian. That you want to test whether the Hamiltonian is right or not. So I'm not much aware of classically what happens in the testing literature, but so far we don't know any testing algorithm as well, which is regress sample convexity. So these results, because we learned the Hamiltonian, we of course can test it, and that gives a way to test. But I do expect that there should be an improvement in sample convexity and time convexity. If we only have to test whether a given Hamiltonian is being implemented or not.
Okay. If there are no more questions, let's thank Anurag again.
Thanks,
Anurag. Send him, wish him all the best for the new endeavor.